Good morning and welcome. Welcome to the slippery slope of lipids and other medical issues. Brought to you by the Triana Prevention Center in Port Charlotte, Florida. A live medical talk show, a live call-in show. And if you'd like to participate in the conversation this morning, you are certainly welcome to. I'll give you the phone numbers now, but we'll repeat them throughout the program as well. 941-206-1580 or 888-441-1580. And now here's your host of the show, Dr. Elizabeth Triana.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Boy, I tell you, we are so excited. We have everybody. We have an incredible, wonderful guest today. And I want to first start off with saying that I would like to salute all our men in arms and women in arms, people who have given up their lives for our country, for freedom. We know this is Memorial Day on Monday. Take a moment, think for a moment, and say, boy, thank God. God bless America, because I know I just went away on a trip, and I got home, and I just said, there's no place like home. And I do believe that, and there's no place like America. And I want to thank my guests from last week, Deborah Dunham. She's a nurse practitioner. She was wonderful. And next week, we have Dr. Paul Popper, cardiologist. And this week, we have such a special person. First of all, her name is Dr. Aurelis Madeira. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank Todd. And Todd's beautiful wife is here today, too, as a guest.
My pleasure.
But I want to thank Dr. Madeira for being here. She is an endocrinologist, and I do want to tell you a story about her. She took care of my father, and my dad just loved her. She was so kind and so sweet. My father has passed about 2 years now, and I'm going to tell you, I love Dr. Madeira. She's a wonderful doctor. And she just was just a shining light to my dad. And I just want to thank her, not only for being a guest today.
Oh, I love him, too. He was great.
Thank you
so much. Like my dad.
Thank you so much. So, because my dad was a diabetic. And today we're going to talk about diabetes. And Dr. Madeira is our guest today. And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I was born in the Dominican Republic. And went to medical school there and came to America, to New York, in 1990. And then I continued my studies. I did 6 years of training in New York. Then I moved to Cleveland and did my 2 years of a specialty in endocrinology in Cleveland Clinic. And then moved to Port Charlotte in 1998 and been here since.
Wow, that's a Cleveland Clinic is incredible.
It is a great place.
It's an awesome place. I've been there because I do advanced lipid testing, and I send it to Cleveland, and I've been there for conferences. It's their whole campus, every place is incredible.
And it's also a great place for any international student or doctor. You know, they're very friendly to be multinational, and that also shines up into the culture of the clinic, being excellence in academics and also being open to the world.
Yes, and I know there's people that fly from all over the world.
Correct.
To go there to be treated. But give us a lot of people are not sure. I know you're an endocrinologist, but explain, most people just think endocrinologist hormones. Mm-hmm. And I know it's more than that.
Okay. The word endocrine sounds a little unfamiliar for most people because it's not a common word that we use to talk every day. But a simple example I will tell my patients and the public in general is think about the inside of your body that you don't see. That's why it's called endocrine. You don't see them, but they are working for you. So if you start from your head, you think about the master gland, which is the pituitary gland that controls all the hormones in the body, including your growth hormone, your sexual hormones, your thyroid hormone, your steroid hormone. And that is the first one you have to think, that pituitary gland. We study that. And then going down in the neck area, there is the thyroid, which is most people know the thyroid is important for your metabolism.
Right.
And we also have parathyroid glands that control your calcium. So those areas we review. And then going down, if you look at your glands in the abdomen, we have the pancreas, which is a famous one for diabetes. When people don't have enough pancreatic function, you develop diabetes. It could be type 1 or type 2, depending on the situation. But also in the belly, we have the adrenal glands, and they control your steroid level. There's other hormones like aldosterone that can cause high blood pressure if you have too much of that. There are other hormones like epinephrine that control your blood pressure, and you make them in the adrenals. So we also review that. And if we go down to the ovaries, you know, that's part of the endocrine system. And for the men, the testicles, the hormones, testosterone, that's also part of what we do. And the last one, obviously, there's all the areas that we review, like osteoporosis, which is for your bone health. And right. then obviously, other things related to hormone health in women who are young, you know, if they have hormone problems with prolactin, or older women who might need to go through menopause or be evaluated for hormonal disorders.
Wow, that's an incredible scope and so important, every one of those organs. And I know you have such an incredible education, but I wanted to narrow today about diabetes.
Correct. Okay.
There is such an epidemic of diabetes. Tell me, what makes people become diabetic? Why are they diabetic? What is diabetes?
Well, diabetes is a condition in which your body is not making insulin or unable to use the insulin you're making. So if you have a young individual who might be healthy otherwise and suddenly got sick and in the hospital with nausea, vomiting, weight loss, the doctor said you had diabetes, that's diabetes type 1. It's basically no insulin production. That is one that we have very little to do to prevent. It's usually autoimmune. That means your body destroys your pancreas, and you don't feel it. You basically, it's ongoing, silent, until you have symptoms. So there are a lot of famous people who have had type 1 diabetes. Like, you know, President Kennedy had type 1 diabetes.
I didn't know that.
Halle Berry has type 1 diabetes. The little Jonas Brothers has type 1 diabetes. Even the famous Tampa Bay player, you know, Sam Fult, he has type 1 diabetes too. So a lot of young people live their lives normally with type 1 diabetes, and they just have to take insulin to replace what they don't make. So that will be about 5 to 7% of all diagnoses we do of diabetes today. Very little, less than 10%.
Okay.
So the big bulk of diabetes today is diabetes type 2. That is a little more complex because you might have a family history of type 2 diabetes like yourself. Therefore, you're very high risk for type 2 diabetes.
Right.
And if you have both parents with type 2 diabetes, you have 100% risk of developing the disease. The matters is not to beat the diagnosis. The matters is to delay the diagnosis. So what we see today, though, is what we never seen 20 years ago. Even when I graduated medical school, we see young people today with type 2 diabetes because they are obese, morbidly obese in their 20s. So they developed the disease at age 30, 35, 40, when they were supposed to delay the disease till they were to be 75.
So these 20-year-olds, it's because they're obese. Explain to us, how does obesity predispose you to becoming a diabetic? And I know our audience, you know, is interested. We can't. So if you could explain that.
Yeah. Obviously, one example I give to my patients is if you have a dog that you decide to adopt and he has been living his life in the woods and he has been active and eating normal, he's usually very, very lean.
Right.
You know, an animal that is in the normal wild is going to be very lean. If you take the same animal and you put it in your house, you give them excessive amount of calories and the animal is not moving around, it's going to develop diabetes. So that's like a simple example for people to understand. We are the same individuals. We just have become very, very slow moving around, exercise-wise, very sedentary, and we have increased the intake of calories. The portion size in America has increased over the last 20 years tremendously.
Right.
There's a lot of supersized trends. Everything is buy one, get one free. And as you know, there is a fight even in New York. The mayor of New York is trying to pass the law to ban the sale of any sodas. They are like, you know, the big size sodas. So basically, you know, the supersize of the meals is an issue, and that has contributed to obesity, along with the lack of exercise.
Yes, yes, it's true. And I think the problem has been is that more and more people are finding out that they don't know what they're eating.
Correct.
And that goes to, and I have on my program, I have tried to teach and explain to people what is a carbohydrate. When people think of sugar, they only think of the sugar that they're putting inside maybe their coffee. They don't realize that a carbohydrate turns into sugar. Mm-hmm. That is bread, pasta, rice. Mm-hmm.
And even if you buy like an apple pie, sugar-free, there's lots of calories there. So the bottom line here is some people say, well, I exercise, I go to the gym, but how many calories do you really burn when you go to the gym? 200 calories, maybe? So how much you have if you buy an apple pie from McDonald's? 250 at least, with a lot of fat and a lot of sugar. And that's supposed to be a snack. So when you look at preventing diabetes, the aim is, number one, exercise 5 days a week, minimum 45 minutes. Minimum 45 minutes.
Wow.
Of significant exercise. No walking and looking at the windows in the mall. No, no. You have to do brisk walking. And if you are a good walker, then you might want to try to run. If you're a good runner, you might want to increase your speed. Because the bottom line here is to increase your metabolic rate. And I can testify to that. You know, I never done a significant, you know, contest, but I just did my first 10K this April.
Congratulations.
So, and one of the motivations I have, number one, exercise prevents diabetes. My mother has type 2 diabetes. I have two brothers with type 2 diabetes.
Oh.
And also exercise has been shown, intensive exercise, that prevents or delay Alzheimer's disease, which is also in my family.
Yes. And also the vascular implications.
Correct.
We know that once you have diabetes, you're at a much higher risk and you're equal to of having a heart attack.
Correct.
The vascular is very important. So if you're interested in preventing the number one killer of men and women, vascular disease, heart attack, then you have to prevent diabetes. So that's great. You're doing it. You're walking the walk. You know, you've heard the walking the walk.
Trying to.
You talk the talk and walk the walk, which is fabulous. But how do you, as a mother, because you see these children more and more are overweight, how do you encourage the kids?
Okay. Well, I am a mother, and I have to admit it's very difficult, especially when they're adolescents. So I believe that has to start when they're little. So we had to teach these children not to eat fast foods. That's the first thing. Number two, as we make a routine at home, whether it's to do homework or to pray at home or to have dinner together, we also have to make a routine of 45 minutes of exercise every day, no fail. So ride your bike or do something, but move around. In fact, the government has a website. It's letsmove.gov.
Okay.
And they want everyone to plan a day, even if it's a Friday, family Friday. Let's just do something together. Let's go and play tennis. You know, Florida, we are privileged here. We have good weather all year round. There's no excuse here to say, I cannot go out. But if you look at the fittest, the people who are the more fitness in America, it's Minnesota and Colorado.
What?
Yes.
Minnesota, where it's so cold?
Yes, but people find a way to exercise. Maybe it's cold, they can go around, they can run around, they maybe do indoors, but they are one of the best places where people have less rates of obesity. Florida in the South is the obesity belt,
yes,
the diabetes belt. And if you go to places like Mississippi, which I've been, you go to Alabama, the amount of obesity you see there, along with the high rate of smoking, is incredible. Along with the South style, Southern cooking style, which includes a lot of fried chicken, a lot of mashed potatoes with lots of butter, and, you know, likely not so much exercise following what we do every day. So it's a sad reality. So when you go back to teach your children, again, we talked about exercise. That's number one. Number two, avoid fast foods. Number three, if they are in sports, do not buy them sport drinks. High in sugar.
High in sugar.
All these sport drinks that you buy around, they're very high in sugar. So you need to bring them an apple and a bottle of water. If they spend 500 calories playing a sport, give them an apple, a bottle of water, and take them home for a healthy lunch. Salad, chicken, maybe some good brown rice, and that would be great. many times when my children were little, when we finished the soccer practice, it will be just like cupcakes, sport drinks, and Doritos.
Oh, so, my goodness. All carbs.
And fat and calories. So you think about how we're teaching these little ones to eat. How can we then, when they become adolescents, give them spinach and broccoli and peppers and tomatoes if we never, ever teach them how to do it when they're little ones?
That's a good point. You got to start at the beginning and do it as a family to help the whole family sit down and do it together to learn. And I want to remind everybody, if you have any questions, give us a call. We're very blessed to have Dr. Aurelius Madera here as our guest. You can call it 206-1580. She is one thing I've always admired about you. I always love going to your lectures because you're such a tremendous teacher.
Thank you.
I could just see you as like a professor. But you do it in a fun way.
Yeah, I love to teach. In fact, my mother is a retired teacher. And, you know, we always teachers one way or another. You know, we teach our patients. We have to teach them. Otherwise,
yes.
You know, they're not going to be able to make changes. We cannot give them orders. We have to make a deal with them and say, can you do this? You know, sometimes I tell them, you know, I am like your teacher, but I have expectations. Otherwise, you don't pass the course. So when you come back, you better bring me some good scores, you know, and that will be likely a lab report or, you know, the blood sugar records and things like that. But I do want one day, maybe in 10 years from now, to join, you know, maybe a Fort Myers College or, you know, Tampa and do some teaching at least half of the day.
That would be wonderful. I could really see you doing that. So is being a teacher, what led you to become a doctor endocrinologist?
Well, my parents are not doctors. You know, I think it was more inspiration. I used to look at the books, and I wear glasses since age 2. I have visual problems. And I used to see the pictures of the scientists in the science books. You know, usually it will be a nice looking person or a lady who was wearing glasses.
Oh.
So I kind of look at myself, you know, and say, well, I want to be a scientist. And then I went to medical school, and in New York, when I was in training, I had good mentors, endocrinologists, good people. And I thought, well, I want to choose a career that I can take care of my children, that I don't have to be on call every single day. But I also want to be a good clinician. So this was a good match for me. And I really enjoy it.
That's great. That's really good. Oh, I know you enjoy it because I can see it. You have such a passion and an interest. And now you're doing 10Ks. Oh, my goodness. That's incredible.
It's very interesting because you think about exercise. You know, many times I see young girls, they used to be active in high school. Like maybe they were doing track or swimming. And suddenly they go to college, they gain 20, 30 pounds, and they think, like, you know, I should be thin like when I was in high school. Well, you cannot change your exercise habits, 1, 2, 3. You have to continue doing something. So exercise is for life. We don't do exercise to lose weight. We exercise to feel good, to prevent diseases, and hopefully, in a way, to give an example to your children that they are going to follow the same. Because sometimes you see the parents who are very obese. And they want their children to exercise and follow a healthy lifestyle. How can you do that? You lead by the example. You have to show your children what is the best, and you hope that they follow you. At least, you know, you try your best. That's all you can do.
That's a great spirit. And I'm sure in this world where you have a lot of patients are very challenging.
Well, you know, diabetes is a very complex disease. You could see 20 patients a day with type 2 diabetes, we're talking about, like we did
right.
At the beginning, we separated them. But they're all different. So even though they all have high blood sugars, they have different lives, and you have to go into what's going on with them. I like always to ask them what they eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I ask them to be honest, and I will give them honest suggestions. I think the eating is crucial for type 2 diabetes because we can give medications, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 medications for diabetes, but we always need a better eating pattern. People need to watch what they eat, and they need to aim to exercise and lose weight. What happens is if you give someone insulin or any of these pills that help your body to use your own insulin, you also are resistant. to the insulin that you are given or that you are making. So the body doesn't recognize the insulin very well, but when you exercise, you are going to be sensitive to your own insulin. So one simple example that I tell the patients is this one. I tell them, you know, if you don't exercise, it's like this example. If you are given a set of furniture on Monday and you fill your house with all the furniture, mm-hmm. and then you get another delivery on Tuesday and the house has another set of furniture, all free, but then on Wednesday you get it again, where are you going to put it? It's free. It's furniture. You want it, but you have no space. Same with the calories. If you don't exercise, even if you don't eat a lot, you're not using the calories. So the body has no space to put the calories for the next day. You got to clean your stores. And the stores are, the storage are the muscles, the liver. And when you do that, you prevent complications and the sugars go down. So even if you're eating okay, you got to move around. And that is one of the things that I like to mention. You know, before you become diabetic, sometimes the doctor might tell you that your liver has fatty changes.
That is so important.
So you might not have diabetes, like say. You have sugar normal, and the doctor say, you know, your liver test is abnormal. And I check the ultrasound, and it showed that you have a fatty liver. That is a very dangerous condition. It tells you that your body is really struggling with that energy. That furniture that I was talking about, there is no place to put that energy. So the body say, you know, I got to go to the liver and storage the fat because it's not being used. So the liver changes and could lead to liver cirrhosis. In fact, it's predicted that in the next 10 years, fatty liver, what we call non-alcoholic fatty liver, is not related to alcohol, might be the first cause or the leading cause of liver cirrhosis and maybe liver transplant in America.
Yeah, right now I did a program on hepatitis C, and mm-hmm. it's hepatitis C. However, you are totally correct about that because people don't understand that. When I tell them, when you eat something, you know, it's not like your body just throws it away, the extra calories. It stores it, the liver and the belly, you know.
The abdominal fat.
The abdominal fat. And especially women after the menopause, they always tell me, I can't seem to lose the belly fat. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you hear that a lot, too.
Yeah, but it's very complex. You know, number one, I think we all have to come to terms that we're getting older. That's number one. I mean, it's not the same being 20 than being 50. Not that, you know, I'm close to 50. I'm not trying to put anybody down. But you have to understand reality. Maybe you had a couple of pregnancies. You know, your abdomen is not going to look the same. So what you need to do is exercise, focus on your core, which is the middle part. And, you know, some people say I exercise, they only do light walking. You have to do push-ups. You have to do some weightlifting. You have to do some abdominal exercises to work in the areas that you think they're a problem. Otherwise, you know, it's basically only aerobic. You know, you just spend calories. You're not working in the problematic areas. So it is not easy, but sometimes there is a genetic background. You know, maybe your mother had that shape and you're just getting it. Some people, you know, Hispanic patients have more abdominal obesity, African Americans. And also if you look at the Oriental patients, you know, Chinese, Japanese, if you take their weight, they might have a normal body mass index by weight and height.
Right.
But then they have the belly. And that is considered to be a significant risk factor for coronary artery disease as well. So that is when we feel that it's a good idea to do measurements of your waist. In that way, we can compare, you know, waist circumference and tell them what it is. And talking about that, you know, for men, for example, sometimes, you know, they wear the belt all the way down to the hips. So abdominal obesity in men is a significant risk factor for coronary artery disease, regardless if they have diabetes or not. And for a man who might not consider himself overweight, he needs to take a look at the belly and say, do I need to work on my belly a little bit? Maybe I can do something to help myself to delay the onset of diabetes or coronary artery disease.
Well, that's one of the ways. On all our patients at the Triana Prevention Center, we measure their waist. We follow that because we know that that's included in metabolic syndrome.
Correct.
Any woman with a waist greater than 35 inches, 40 inches in men, and the numbers lower in Asians.
Correct.
So the whole thing is we're trying to prevent. I tell patients we can prevent the diagnosis of diabetes because a lot of people don't understand the concept that you have insulin resistance 10 to 15 years before you get diagnosed with diabetes. Mm-hmm.
And we see that a lot, and it's very sad. I'm going to give you a note on a young woman I saw the other day, 16-year-old Hispanic, whose body mass index is 42.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's so very high.
Very
for
high.
Our audience,
normal
should be 25 and less.
Correct. So she's 42, body max index. And, you know, she has the significant problems of a young woman who's very obese and has very high risk for type 2 diabetes in the future. She's already insulin resistant.
Right.
Even though she has normal blood sugar. So what is she showing? She's showing skin tags, which are little bumps that can appear in your neck. She's showing excessive hair on her upper lip or maybe in her chest. That's called hirsutism. She's showing irregular menstrual cycles, which is a sign of infertility or polycystic ovarian syndrome. And she's also showing some lab work like high triglycerides and low HDL. We are talking about a 16-year-old girl. And if the parents do not put themselves together and help her to lose weight, before age 25, she will have a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes or at least gestational diabetes. So with her, it's a very difficult conversation with a young person because they get very sensitive. The parents are really the one that have the power to take care of this. So I saw her like 4 months ago, and I talked. She's Hispanic, so we talked about the white rice. We talked about the white bread. We right. talked about the cookies, the ice cream, and the need to exercise more. So when I saw her recently, they came together. She joined the gym, and she lost 7 pounds.
Wow.
So it's not a cure yet, but there is a trend that she's doing better. And that is very rewarding.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's without any medications, that's without any expensive plans, just by looking at the diet, eating more greens, staying away from a lot of carbohydrates. And, you know, one of the things about carbohydrates is that people need to understand carbohydrates are for energy. If you are just watching Fox News or CNN or playing games or just using your phone at home and a computer as a young person, you're using very little energy. So you don't need a lot of carbohydrates. So you were having, we were talking about how many carbohydrates we should have
right.
per meal.
A lot of patients, and I've tried to explain to everyone what is a carbohydrate, but a lot of people don't know how much carbohydrate should I take.
Okay. Well, in normal situations, if you are running a 5 mile a day routine, you know, you could have over 100 grams of carbohydrate in your diet. You know, you're running, you need carbohydrates, that's fine. So what you don't want to do is eat it in one meal. You need to spread them through the day. We like you to use it when you're using the energy, like breakfast and lunch. We hope that you're active in the afternoon. And as we go to bed at night, most of us, some people don't sleep a lot, but some people that work nights, right? But most of us will kind of take off, you know, in the night. So it's not good to have the main meal at night. So the American diet, you know, if you think about the very busy cities like New York, Chicago, most people have a coffee for breakfast. That's not a healthy breakfast.
No.
Maybe they will skip lunch. They get home dead tired, very hungry, and they'll have their 100 carbohydrate load at dinner. So that's the problem. At night, your body is going to use all the energy. Remember the furniture example?
Yes.
There's no place to put that because it's been stored. The storage is full. So you basically have a big load and a high risk for diabetes. So what is ideal? That you spread those 100 to 120 grams per day. You can do, you know, breakfast, you can do 30 grams. That'll be 2 slices of toast. You know, that will be 30 grams. If you want to do 40 grams, you can have a piece of fruit, a glass of milk. You can have maybe 8 ounce orange juice. That will be about 45 grams, 50 grams. The carbohydrate part. You want to put protein in that meal. You also want to put some little fat. It's okay. A little bit of good butter or maybe a piece of cheese. For lunch, you want to have a nice amount of protein. That could be a chicken breast or it could be a piece of salmon. You can have a potato. That will be 20 grams, medium size. And that should make a good lunch. You know, or replace that with maybe a cup of rice. Or maybe a cup of pasta. The problem with the carbohydrates is that many restaurants will give you gigantic portions. So we're talking about a cup. We're not talking about a large plate. And then you want to have some snacks in the afternoon so you don't feel deprived. So an apple, a pear, a few strawberries, 6 to 8 almonds, you know, maybe a few cashews. It's a good snack for the afternoon.
Right.
Lots of water. And then you go to dinner. You're really not going to feel as hungry. But if you want to have a serving of carbs, it's okay. You want to have a lot of greens, So you can maybe go for a walk after dinner and then go to sleep, and you don't have to give your liver so much energy to use through the night.
That sounds like a really good plan. We need to follow that. That's a wonderful plan.
Certainly sounds like the kind of thing we should all be doing. It's easier to say it sounds like a good plan and then actually act on it. I know from firsthand experience. Let me just take a quick second to remind everybody that they are listening to The Slippery Slope of Lipids and Other Medical Issues. And you are welcome to call and join the conversation. If you have a question for the doctors in our studio today, you're welcome to pick up the phone and call 941-206-1580 or 888-441-1580. Our program is brought to you by the Triana Prevention Center in Port Charlotte, Florida, which, by the way, you can look up on the web at TrianaPreventionCenter.com. That's T-R-I-A-N-A, PreventionCenter.com. Let's go back to our doctors. Before that, though, I wanted to contribute one tiny little factoid to the conversation that's probably the only thing I know that I can contribute at this point. You were talking before about how different states have different rates of obesity and various amounts of activity for different people right. In different parts of the country. Did you know the number one state in the country for people who walk to work percentage-wise is Alaska?
Wow.
That says something. If you can do it in Alaska, we can do it in Florida.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's the highest percentage of people who walk. 7.3%,
really,
I want to say, or something like that.
That is really something, because it's really, that's rough weather there.
Sure.
Yeah, and if you look at our Port Charlotte, Punta Gorda, we have so many places where people can go. And we have the parks, you know, there's no need to pay in the parking. So there's very little excuse. Sometimes in the wintertime, patients tell me it's too cold, you know, 60 degrees. And in the summer, it's too hot, you know. So I think we just have to make a deal and understand that we need to exercise and then forget about the excuses.
It is. And you know what? I don't understand, because it's the hardest thing to get people to exercise. But once they do, everybody says, I feel so good.
Well,
I feel so good. That's what, you know.
Exercise raises your good hormones that we want to be in the top in our system, including serotonin, which is the hormone that goes up when you take an antidepressant.
Right.
See, so basically serotonin boost is an exercise routine. So if you are feeling down and sad and you don't want to take a pill that your doctor want to give you, go for the run and you'll have a nice amount of serotonin. The other one that goes up is endorphins. Endorphins, what they do is they help you look at your life a little better. It gives you a sense of, you know, control, and it takes away all the anxiety as well. So I think, you know, both of them are positive things. And, you know, if you don't have money to go to the gym, you know, the sidewalks are free.
Well, we all know, too, people who exercise, they've been done research. They have better sex lives also.
Correct. And some of that has to do with the way how they feel about their own body.
Right.
You know, many times we ask our body to be perfect, but we don't take care of it.
Right.
So, you know, it's part of the functions. You know, some of the questions that many people have, you know, men and women, about sexual dysfunction comes from home. You know, they might not have had a time to explore their sexual life, work on it, and also take care of their bodies. So they have lost the capacity to understand that they're still attractive. It's just a matter of keeping yourself on the same pace.
I think that's very important. And I always commend patients who are older, instead of, you know, who are active and also take an interest in their bodies to look good and feel better. And I feel that also contributes very highly to a good sexual life.
Correct.
Which is very important, and I think that's important for everyone, no matter what age they are. Well, one of the questions patients have asked me, and I wanted to bring this up. You said about the carbohydrates, all right? 100 grams of carbs. So if you're a diabetic, you should, most people, we want them to have less than 150 or 100 grams of carbs. But you're saying if they exercise.
Well, the bottom line here is, if you are not hungry, do you need to eat? You know, if you are not active and you're basically not expending any energy, do you really have to have 3 meals a day? If you are having, if you're taking medications that can lower your blood sugar below the normal, you might need to eat more frequent meals to avoid low sugars. But otherwise, if you take medications for diabetes, for example, metformin.
Right.
Metformin is a medication you take twice a day. It doesn't give you low sugars. So if you want to follow a low carbohydrate diet, you know, that's fine, and you can lose weight. If you take metformin plus, there are many other pills we use now. Some of them are called DPP-4 inhibitors, and those include Januvia, Onglyza, Tradjenta, or the injectables called GLP-1, Victoza, Byetta, and Bydureon. If you combine metformin with us, those drugs, you don't have to eat on a schedule. So sometimes I ask the patients, what is the main meal of the day? And they give me the three meals.
Oh.
Well, breakfast is good, lunch is good, dinner is good. So you really shouldn't have three big meals. I mean, are you really spending all the energy for three big meals? How many calories are we talking about? 3,000, 4,000 calories? Because we don't ask for the snacks and the desserts and all that. So you don't have to have three big meals, number one. Number two, snacks in between are not necessary and not recommended. And number three, unless you have a medication that causes low sugar, you don't need to eat as much. If you're having low sugars with the medication you're taking, you need to notify your doctor. The medications need to be changed.
Okay. But a lot of times patients will tell me that when they eat carbohydrates, they get very, very sleepy.
Okay. Well, the reason is, you know, that's one of the reasons why we have siesta in the Spanish world. I don't know if you know, but, you know, siesta, you know, is a routine. You know, with the new things, with the industries and working through lunch, we kind of lost that. But it used to be, even in Dominican Republic, you know, at noon, every store will be closed and it opens at 2 p.m. And the reason for that is from the old Spaniards, you know, rice is the main meal for lunch.
Right.
So when people have a nice plate of rice, you raise your insulin production, even if you're not diabetic. So why do we get sleepy after we eat a big portion of pasta or rice? It's because your pancreas is forced to make lots of insulin. And insulin is going to make you feel sleepy because you're supposed to go to take a rest from the other activities because you need to take care of that amount of carbohydrates you had.
And a lot of people don't realize that insulin is a hormone.
Correct. It is a hormone. And the body is such a beautiful, perfect machine. If you think about, if you don't eat for the whole day, you still make insulin, but you don't get low blood sugars. Your body helps you to keep your sugars normal. So the body will be helping you not to become diabetic unless you push it, you know, almost like setting it up. When I see in the supermarket, you know, the little ones, and I see the parents buying the gigantic bags of all the chips available, 2 for 1, I'm thinking, you know, they're just preparing these little ones to become diabetics. And it's really sad. You know, obesity in America is one of the things that we have not been able to handle right. And there are a few things that people are doing. California was the first one that banned all the sodas in the schools. Mm-hmm. And now they're changing. You know, the school is trying to do better lunches. But we had issues forever that we'll never address until the recent administration with the first lady trying to make some changes there in the school system. Otherwise, you know, it's like nobody is looking at that. You know, you just let it go.
Well, and that's why we're trying to educate people through this program to let people know there's choices. I think, personally, the most important thing is to learn how to make your own choices. I don't think the government or Big Daddy should come and tell you what to do. I think you should know, have the knowledge, and say, wait a minute, this is a carbohydrate. I'm eating too many carbohydrates. I have a family history of diabetes. Let me cut back. Because really, it comes down to personal choices.
That is correct. But remember, we have a lot of influence in the media. And when people are very poor and they offer a very low-cost lunch or dinner, there's a very good temptation there to go ahead and eat that meal. So I understand what you're saying. I agree with you. And this is because we know about it, but there's a lot of people who don't have the knowledge who might just be swayed by the propaganda. So that's our job, too, to educate our community. And maybe, you know, like just, you know, maybe in your own family, your own church, your own school system, we can at least teach them, like you're saying, how to eat right, how to look at the labels. That's very important, how to read the labels, because, you know, the food might look good to you. It might say fat-free. But then you look at how many calories you have and what is the serving size. You know, some of the ice creams that you can buy out there, you know, a small portion, it could be 300 calories, and that will be almost 100% fat. Don't want to choose that one for your dessert, that's for sure.
One thing I find with patients, it's hard to explain to them because they say, you know, I feel good. I feel good. I'm doing whatever I want to do. They don't understand, if you could discuss with us, the consequences of diabetes, the eye, the kidney, for example. People don't seem to understand because they say, I feel good.
Correct. And I feel good is a statement in which, you know, people will say, I don't want to see a doctor. They're going to give me pills and whatever it takes. But I think the understanding that diabetes is a silent killer will give them the right message. Diabetes could be on you for 20 years, and you might feel nothing until one day you wake up and you cannot see. You broke a vessel in your eye, and you need laser treatment. And that was a patient that I saw about 10 years ago from Cleveland. He came to me because he went to the eye doctor first. He couldn't drive. And mm-hmm. when he went to the eye doctor, he said, well, maybe you have diabetes. Well, he didn't see a doctor for about 10 years. And right after I saw him, about a year later, he had a bypass, coronary artery bypass. Why? About 50% of people that get admitted with chest pain and something, you know, related to the heart will be pre-diabetics or diabetics that didn't know about it.
Right.
Because that might be the first time they've been diagnosed with diabetes. So this is a real story from a real person that can tell you how is the impact of this silent killer. And obviously, you know, some people will have an infection one day. Maybe they end in the hospital with diverticulitis, which is an inflammation of the intestine, or need to have gallbladder surgery. And then they will discover why they should have gone to the doctor before. Because when you have diabetes and the sugars are very high, you have a very high rate of infections and complications, especially if you need surgery.
Right. And the fact, too, that long-term diabetes, I tell patients, it kills your kidneys.
Correct.
Your vascular system, how many patients? You don't see it as much, but you can still see it where patients even have to have amputations.
Correct. And it is the number one cause of dialysis in America.
Yes.
Diabetes is the number one cause of blindness in America. Diabetes, still now.
Still.
Yeah. So we're not talking about a simple disease. We're talking about a disease that is very common. It's an epidemic. But the good side of it is it can be controlled. You know, more and more today we see people that have been diabetic for many, many years. And
right.
they might not have any complications because they took good care of it from the beginning. They can live a long life with diabetes well controlled. So not everything is negative. We can see a light at the end. We just need the involvement of the patient, the family, and understanding that this is not just a physician giving somebody a list to do. You have to feel like I'm in charge, and we are, as physicians, pretty much like empowering the patient to do it, because you can't do their lives. They go home for 3 months, and they see you in 3 months, and they have to do their lives in either way they eat, but it has to be something that has to come from within.
Well, that's very, very important. It's true, the light within. And I've always stressed here, too, that we're looking for more good years of life, and also for the people that we love. The people we love, we want them to be around for a long time also.
Correct. And that is a good point. You know, sometimes they tell me, well, you know, I'm 70, I'm old, you know, I'm ready to go. So then I might make a point in telling them, you know, how about your wife? How about your grandchildren? You know, how about the people you love? I'm sure you make a big impact in their lives. So let's just take away the negative side and look at the way of the future. None of us know when we're going to die, right?
Right.
We don't know. So as we don't know, there's no way to say I'm old or I'm young. You know, I feel that everyone should be treated the same way, whether you're young or old, because really it's a medical problem that we treat. We're not treating the aging process. We're treating a disease. And, you know, if they understand it that way, then it's not as difficult. And you know, and one thing I wanted to say, you don't have to be perfect to be in good control. You still could have a day that you eat a little more. You still could have a week that you don't exercise. It will not have an impact on your blood sugars as much as if you never do it. So you could be imperfect and still be a good patient, keep your good control. And we know we are all humans. We're all imperfect. So that is accepted in the list. What you don't want is somebody to say, well, you know, I will start exercising next year because this year I'm too busy. have to find that time within that niche that you do something even once or twice a week.
That's very good. I know you're really stressing that, and I totally agree. There seems to be a lot of confusion with patients, also who see other physicians, on how do you diagnose diabetes?
Well, diabetes is diagnosed by blood test.
Right.
And we call the blood test fasting blood sugar. So that means you do it in the morning and you're fasting, and it's a blood sugar, which is the glucose. So the criteria today for diabetes is 126 and higher for glucose. So you go to the lab, the sugar's over 126, you are diagnosed formally diabetic. But over 100 is abnormal.
Right.
So if you have a sugar between 100 to 125, you consider pre-diabetic. Now, what I tell the patients is, consider yourself diabetic and start your diet at this point, because it's just a matter of time. See, so you can start the counseling and the diet and the exercise even if you're pre-diabetic. If you happen to have any sugar random throughout the day, you're not fasting, and it's over 200, it's considered to be also criteria for diabetes. If you are sick and you're in the hospital, somebody gave you steroids, prednisone, or you have an infection and your sugars are high, you are likely a diabetic, and do not say, I am not a diabetic and I was just sick, my sugars went up for a little while, because the body was preparing to become diabetic and the infection just kind of triggered the high sugars. They might come back to normal, but your disease is not going to go away. It's just right there silent, waiting to happen again. The other criteria is a blood test that we do. It's called hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is more sophisticated test because it gives us a 3-month average of your sugars. So you could be normal today, but if you were abnormal a month ago or 2 months ago, we can catch it on that test. So the A1C is a percentage. That's what the number is, a percentage. So normal should be less than 6.5 or considered to be not diabetic. So if you had that test and it's 6.5 or higher, you are formally diagnosed as diabetic. But you could have a test that is lower and your sugar could be higher than 126. You're also diabetic. So it doesn't have to be the two of them. It could be either or.
Right. And I also, and with my patients too, I also use a 2-hour glucose tolerance test, and which we've explained before. But you're right. Some patients say, well, you know, my A1C is high, but my fasting is always good. Again, just what you explained, you said it so simply. It's a matter of looking at the past 3 months.
And the A1C also reflects the fasting and the after the meal, which you call postprandial.
Right.
So when you're diabetic early, the fasting might be okay. But after you have a nice amount of carbohydrates, like a serving of mashed potatoes, or you have a brownie, then you spike tremendously because the load of carbohydrates cannot be handled by your body. So postprandial, or after the meal, like you said, 2 hours after the meal, is sometimes the only thing that we can see when you are early diabetic.
Well, it just seems like this has been such an incredible show. You're a great guest, and I have so many topics I wanted to cover. There's not enough time. Because I wanted to talk a little bit about treatment and the waves of treatment in the future, since you're at the forefront of this too. Before our time goes.
We mentioned metformin, which is the first line. Metformin is a very good drug. It's a pill.
It's free at Publix.
Correct. So you take it twice a day with meals. And then we have second line drugs, which are, we mentioned them before, they're called DPP-4 inhibitors or GLP-1 receptor agonists. They're very well known out there, Januvia, Onglyza, Tragenta, Victoza, Byetta, Bydureon. The beauty of this second-line drug is there is no hypoglycemia or low sugar. When you use the cheaper drug, which is going to be a sulfonylurea, and the names are glimepiride, glipizide, glaburide, they are cheap, but they cause low sugar reactions. So they are a little bit dangerous for people with diabetes, and we talked about that before. The low sugar not only can give you trouble if you're driving or you're sleeping, but it also can make you eat more and gain weight. And then we have more drugs. We have insulin that always we use if we need it. Insulin is always a good drug because it's a replacement hormone. The body doesn't make it. We give it to you. And we have new drugs. There's a new one called Invokana that makes your body get rid of sugar in the urine. So that's a new mechanism of action. Just 2 months, the FDA approved this. And we have other medications, which we don't use a lot. One of them is called bromocriptine that works in your brain. Mm-hmm. And then we have another medication called Welchol that helps your body to get rid of the sugar in the intestine. And, you know, diabetes is very complex. Sometimes we have to use 1, 2, 3 drugs plus insulin. And that's the way we do it because it's not a simple disease to treat.
Well, I tell you, you've been really a great guest. But tell us where you're located and your phone number, because I know there's people out there going, wow, she's really great.
My office is on Tamiami Trail, in the service road next to the fire station. It's 3611 Tamiami Trail in Suite B. And the phone is 941-235-0542.
Okay. And I was just thinking this. Do you hear them, the sirens, every other moment?
It's nice to have the fire station on your side. You know, it's nice. If you get somebody that gets ill, you know, you can just call them and they're right there with you. They're very good people to be neighbors of.
Too. I'm sure. I remember when I was a little kid in New York and I just went to visit my grandmother and the fire station was across the street. Mm. And there was this big fire. And when you're a little kid, you know, you're impressionable and you could hear them ringing. I actually got scared because it was on the second floor. And how am I going to get out of here?
Well, New York is, you know, New York City. You always hear the sirens. You know, that's not like in Port Charlotte. We're more quiet here.
I know it's much quiet, but it's such a beautiful place. I love living here.
Of course, yes. It's our home.
It is. It's really nice.
We've got about 2 minutes left in the program, so I wanted to kind of sound the 2-minute warning. If anybody has a question or comment they want to sneak in under the wire, now would be the time to do it. 941-206-1580 or 888-441-1580. Actually, I had a quick question for the doctor before all time runs out, because you had mentioned about the connections between hormones, brain chemistry, and depression. And I was wondering, have you ever seen in your practice where somebody is taking an antidepressant and if they begin an exercise program that they maybe need less of that or don't need it at all?
Correct. So many times depression is multifactorial, and it might be you might feel depressed because you don't like how your body looks. You mm-hmm. know, you might feel tired and we think it's depression. Mm-hmm. But once you start an exercise routine, you don't feel depressed anymore and you don't need the medication. Also, one thing I want to mention quickly is low testosterone in men. If you are a man and your testosterone is low and you're young and healthy, it might be that you need to exercise more. That will boost your testosterone. And also sleep disorders. If you have a sleep apnea or you just don't sleep well, you like to be late, late owl, you might want to sleep better. A sleep hygiene will help you to raise your testosterone level. So obviously, it can do better than that.
Very good.
That's really great. I want to thank Dr. Aurelius Madera. Her office is here in Port Charlotte. And this is Dr. Elizabeth Triana speaking from the Triana Prevention Center. I would love to invite you again and in the future. And I think the topic about hormones would be great, too.
My pleasure.
It'd be really great. And I want to thank everyone today. And thank you all. And stay healthy. And God bless America.